atoms of one element spontaneously disintegrated to form atoms of another. Thomson's and Rutherford's discoveries in particular were a revelation because they related to the atom and its parts, which it turned out cannot be described employing Newton's laws or even his conceptual framework. And so their observations, it would eventually be realized, demanded a whole new approach to physics. But if both the theoretical and experimental developments of the day were dizzying, the initial reaction of the physics community to most of it was to take a chill pill and pretend none of it was happening. So not only were Planck's quantum and Einstein's photon dismissed, but so were these revolutionary experiments. Prior to 1905, those who thought the atom was metaphysical nonsense treated talk of electrons, a supposed component of the atom, about as seriously as an atheist might treat a debate about whether God is a man or a woman. More surprising is the fact that those who did believe in atoms didn't like the electron either, because the electron was a supposed part of the atom, and the atom was supposed to be indivisible. So outlandish did Thomson's electron seem that one distinguished physicist told him that upon hearing of his claim, he thought Thomson was pulling their legs. Similarly, Rutherford's idea that an atom of one element can decay into an atom of another was dismissed as if it had come from someone who had grown a long beard and donned an alchemist's robe. In 1941, scientists would learn how to convert mercury to gold, literally the alchemist's dream, by bombarding that metal with neutrons in a nuclear reactor. But in 1903, Rutherford's colleagues were not adventurous enough to accept his bold claims regarding that transmutation of elements. Ironically, they were adventurous enough to play with the glowing radioactive trinkets Rutherford provided them, thus irradiating themselves with rays from the process they believed was not taking place. The spate of strange research papers from both theoretical and experimental physicists must have seemed to many like the physics equivalent of today's social psychology literature, in which researchers regularly claim to have made wild discoveries such as people who eat grapes have more car accidents. But actually, though the physicists' conclusions sounded outlandish, they were correct. And eventually, the accumulating experimental evidence, together with Einstein's theoretical arguments, forced physicists to accept the atom and its parts. For his work leading to the discovery of the electron, Thomson won the 1906 Nobel Prize in Physics, while Rutherford received the Nobel Prize in 1908, but in chemistry, for what amounted to the discovery that the robed alchemist had been onto something. This then was the scene in 1909 when Niels Bohr entered the physics research picture. He was just 5 years younger than Einstein, but the gap was large enough to make him of a new generation, one that entered a field that had finally accepted both the atom and the electron, though still not the photon. For his PhD dissertation, Bohr chose to analyze and critique Thomson's theories. When he was finished, he applied for and received a grant that allowed him to work in Cambridge so he could get the great man's reactions. The debate of ideas is a key feature of science, so for Bohr to approach Thomson with his criticism was not quite like an art student approaching Picasso to say his faces have too many angles, but it was close. And Thomson, indeed, did not prove anxious to grant his upstart critic an audience. Bohr would stay almost a year, but Thomson would not discuss the dissertation with him, or even read it. Thomson's inattention would prove to be a blessing in disguise, for while Bohr was languishing in Cambridge, failing in his plan to engage Thomson, he met Rutherford, who had come visiting. Rutherford had himself worked under Thomson in his younger days, but by then he was the world's leading experimental physicist and director of a center for the study of radiation at the University of Manchester. Unlike Thomson, Rutherford appreciated Bohr's ideas, and he invited him to come work in his laboratory. Rutherford and Bohr would make an odd pair. Rutherford was a huge, energetic man, both broad and tall, with a strong face and a thundering voice so loud that it sometimes disturbed sensitive equipment. Bohr had a delicate nature and was far gentler in both looks and manner, with droopy cheeks, a soft voice, and a slight speech impediment. Rutherford had a thick New Zealand accent. Bohr spoke poor Danish-sounding English. Rutherford, when contradicted in a conversation, would listen with interest, but then let the conversation end without making a reply. Bohr lived for debate and had a hard time thinking creatively unless there was another person in the room to bounce ideas off and debate with. The pairing with Rutherford was a lucky break for Bohr, for though Bohr went to Manchester thinking he might conduct experiments on the atom, after he arrived, he instead became obsessed with a theoretical model of the atom that Rutherford was working out, based on Rutherford's own experimental studies. It was through the theoretical work he did on that Rutherford atom that Bohr would revive the dormant quantum idea and accomplish what Einstein's work on the photon hadn't. He would put the quantum idea on the map to stay. When Bohr arrived in Manchester, Rutherford was doing experiments to investigate how the electric charge in the atom is distributed. He had decided to study that issue by analyzing the way charged particles are deflected when they are fired, like bullets, at an atom. For the charged projectiles, he chose alpha particles, which he himself had discovered, and which we today know are simply positively charged helium nuclei. Rutherford hadn't yet concocted his model of the atom, but he was assuming that the atom would conform pretty well with another model, one developed by Thomson. The proton and nucleus were not then known, and in Thomson's model, the atom consisted of a diffuse fluid of positive charge in which enough tiny electrons circulate to offset the positive electricity. Since electrons weigh very little, Rutherford expected that, like marbles in the path of a cannonball, they'd have little effect on the course of the massive alpha particles. It was the much heavier fluid of positive charge and the manner in which it was distributed that Rutherford sought to study. Rutherford's apparatus was simple. A beam of alpha particles was created from a radioactive substance, such as radium, and aimed at a thin piece of gold foil. Beyond the foil stood a small target screen. After the alpha particles passed through the foil, they would hit the screen, producing a tiny and very faint flash of light. Sitting in front of the screen with a magnifying glass, one could, with some effort, record its position and determine the degree to which the alpha particle had been deflected by the atoms in the foil. Though Rutherford was world famous, the work and the work environment were the opposite of glamorous. The lab was in a damp, gloomy basement with pipes running across both floor and ceiling. The ceiling was so low that you might bang your head on it, and the floor so uneven that you might then trip on one of the pipes in the floor before the pain in your head had even subsided. Rutherford himself lacked the patience required for making the measurements, and after trying it on one occasion for only 2 minutes, he swore and gave up. His assistant, German Hans Geiger, on the other hand, was a demon at the tedious task. Ironically, he would later negate the value of his own skill by inventing the Geiger counter. Rutherford expected that most of the heavy, positively charged alpha particles would pass through the foil in the spaces between the gold atoms, too far from any of them to be noticeably deflected. But some, he theorized, would pass through one or more of the atoms and thus deviate a tiny bit from a straight path, repulsed by their diffuse positive charges. The experiment would indeed elucidate the structure of the atom, but by luck, rather than in the manner he had envisioned. At first, all the data Geiger collected conformed to Rutherford's expectations and appeared consistent with the Thomson model. Then, one day in 1909, Geiger suggested a small research project for a young undergraduate student named Ernest Marsden to get his feet wet. Rutherford, who had been sitting in on a class on probability theory in the math department, realized that there might be a small chance that a few of the alpha particles were being deflected by a somewhat larger angle than his apparatus was designed to detect. And so he suggested to Geiger that Marsden perform a variation on their experiment to look into that possibility. Marsden got to work looking for particles that had experienced larger deviations than Geiger had previously been looking for, even very large deflections that, if they occurred, would violate everything Rutherford knew about the structure of the atom. That task was, in Rutherford's view, almost certain to be nothing more than a mammoth waste of time. In other words, it was a fine project for an undergrad. Marsden dutifully watched as alpha particle after alpha particle traveled through the foil as expected, with no dramatic deflections. And then, that which was virtually unimaginable finally occurred. A scintillation appeared in the detection screen while it had been positioned far off center. In the end, of the many thousands of alpha particles Marsden observed, just a handful were deflected at wide angles, but one or two of those bounced back almost boomerang style. That was enough. After hearing the news, Rutherford said that it was quite the most incredible event that had ever happened to me in my life. It was almost as incredible as if you had fired a 15-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper and it came back and hit you. He reacted this way because his mathematics told him that there had to be something inconceivably small and powerful in the gold foil to cause infrequent but large deflections like that. And so, Rutherford hadn't elucidated the details of the Thomson model after all. He had discovered that the Thomson model was wrong. In advance of carrying out Marsden's experiment, the project had seemed outlandish, the sort of activity Feynman was warning me not to engage in. In the century since its execution, however, the experiment has universally been praised as brilliant. And indeed, without it, there would likely have been no Bohr atom, meaning that a coherent theory of the quantum would likely have come, assuming it still would have come, many years later. That, in turn, would have had a great effect on what we call technological progress. It would have delayed the development of the atom bomb, for one, meaning the bomb would not have been used on Japan, thus saving the lives of numerous innocent Japanese civilians, but perhaps costing the lives of numerous soldiers who'd have perished in an Allied invasion. It also would have put off many other inventions, such as the transistor, and thus the start of the computer age. It's hard to say exactly what all the effects of not performing that single, seemingly pointless undergraduate experiment would have been, but it's safe to say that the world today would look quite different. And so here again we see the fine line between an outlandish crackpot project and an innovative idea that changes everything. In the end, Rutherford oversaw numerous further experiments in which Geiger and Marsden observed more than 1 million scintillations. From this data, he would fashion his theory about the structure of the atom, a theory that was different from Thomson's in that, while it still portrayed the electrons as moving in concentric orbits, the positive charge was no longer spread out, but rather concentrated at the atom's tiny center. Geiger and Marsden, though, would soon part ways. They would find themselves fighting on opposite sides in World War I, and then applying their science on opposite sides in World War II. While Marsden worked on the new technology of radar, Geiger, a Nazi supporter, worked to develop a German atom bomb. The Rutherford atom is the model we all learn in grade school, in which electrons orbit the nucleus just as planets orbit the sun. Like many concepts of science, it seems uncomplicated when boiled down to an everyday simile like that classroom model. But the idea's true brilliance lies in precisely those technical complexities that are lost in the distillation process that produces such simple pictures. To have an intuitive picture is helpful, but what brings an idea in physics to life are the mathematical consequences it implies. And so a physicist must be not just a dreamer, but a technician. To Rutherford the dreamer, the experiment said that the vast majority of the atom's mass, and all of its positive charge, must be concentrated at its center, in an incredibly tiny ball of charged matter so dense that a mere cupful of that material would weigh 100 times as much as Mount Everest. He would later call that central core of the atom the nucleus. That you and I don't weigh anything near that much is a testament to the fact that the nucleus is only a minuscule dot at the center of the atom, which is otherwise made up of mostly empty space. Rutherford the technician ground through the complex technical mathematics to find that indeed If the picture he'd imagined was true, his experiment would produce precisely the observations he and his team had made. Most of the fast, heavy alpha particles would pass through the gold foil, missing the minute atomic centers, and as a result it would be only slightly affected. Meanwhile, a few, those that passed close to a nucleus, would encounter an intense force field, causing a large deflection. The strength of that force field must have seemed as science fiction-like to Rutherford as the force fields in the movies seem to us today. But even if we can't yet create such fields in our macro world, they do exist within the atom. The important point that Rutherford had discovered is that the positive charge in the nucleus is concentrated at its center, not spread out. His portrayal of the electrons as orbiting the nucleus as the planets do the sun, on the other hand, was completely wrong, and he knew it. First, the analogy of the solar system ignores the interaction among the planets in the solar system, and likewise, among the different electrons in an atom. Those interactions are not at all alike. The planets, which have quite a bit of mass, but no net electric charge, interact via gravity. Electrons, which are charged, but have little mass, interact through the pull of the electromagnetic force. Gravity is an extremely weak force, so the pull the planets exert on one another is so small that for many practical purposes it can be ignored. The electrons, however, exert on one another an enormously strong electromagnetic repulsion that would quickly disrupt those nice circular orbits. The other glaring issue was that both planets and electrons that move in a circle will emit waves of energy. Gravitational energy in the case of planets, and electromagnetic energy in the case of electrons. Again, because gravity is so weak, in the billions of years our solar system has existed, the planets wouldn't have lost more than a few percent of their energy. In fact, this effect wasn't even known until Einstein's theory of gravity predicted it in 1916. On the other hand, because the electromagnetic force is so strong, according to Maxwell's theory, Rutherford's orbiting electrons would radiate away all their energy and plummet into the nucleus in about 1/100,000,000th of a second. In other words, if Rutherford's model were true, the universe as we know it would not exist. If ever there was a prediction you'd think was likely to sink a theory, it would be the prediction that the universe does not exist. So why was it taken seriously? That illustrates another important point about progress in physics. Most theories are not sweeping theories of grand scope, but rather specific models meant to account for a particular situation. And so even if they have drawbacks, and one is aware that a model fails in some situations, it can nonetheless be useful. In the case of the Rutherford atom, physicists who worked on the atom appreciated that his model made correct predictions regarding the nucleus, and assumed that some future experiment would reveal essential missing facts that would settle the issue of how the electrons entered the picture and why the atom was stable. What was not apparent was that the atom was demanding not a more clever explanation, but a revolutionary one. The pale and modest Niels Bohr, however, had a different take on things. To young Bohr, the Rutherford atom and its contradictions were a haystack that held a golden needle, and he was determined to find it. Bohr posed a question to himself. If the atom doesn't send off waves of energy as classical theory demands, at least according to Rutherford's model, could that be because the atom doesn't obey classical laws? To pursue that line of reasoning, Bohr turned to Einstein's work on the photoelectric effect. He asked, what would it mean if the quantum idea applied to the atom as well? That is, what if the atom, like Einstein's light quanta, could only have certain energies? The idea led him to revise Rutherford's model and create what would come to be called the Bohr atom. Bohr explored his idea by focusing his attention on the simplest atom, hydrogen, which consists of a single electron orbiting a nucleus made of a single proton. The difficulty of Bohr's undertaking is illustrated by the fact that it wasn't even obvious at the time that hydrogen did have that simple structure. Bohr had to deduce that hydrogen has just one electron from a series of experiments performed by Thomson. Newtonian physics predicts that an electron can circle a nucleus, which in the case of hydrogen is just a proton, at any distance, as long as its speed and energy have the proper values, which are determined by that distance. The smaller the electron's distance from the proton, the lower the atom's energy must be. But suppose, in the spirit of Einstein, that we were to contradict Newtonian theory by adding a new law dictating that, for some as yet unknown reason, an atom is not free to have just any energy, but rather only a value belonging to some discrete set of possibilities. Since the orbital radius is determined by the energy, that restriction on the energy values allowed would translate into a restriction on the possible radii at which an electron can orbit. When we make this assumption, we say that the atom's energy and the radii of the electron orbits are quantized. Bohr postulated that if the properties of an atom are quantized, the atom cannot continuously spiral inward toward the nucleus and lose energy as classical Newtonian theory predicts. Instead, the atom can lose energy only in clumps as it jumps from one allowed orbit to another. According to Bohr's model, when an atom is excited by an energy input, for instance from a photon, the absorbed energy causes an electron to jump to one of the farther out higher energy orbits. And each time a jump is made back to a smaller, lower energy orbit, a quantum of light, a photon, is emitted with a frequency corresponding to the difference in energy between the two orbits. Now suppose that, again, for some yet unknown reason, there is an innermost allowed orbit, an orbit of lowest energy, which Bohr dubbed the ground state. In that case, when the electron reaches that state, it can no longer lose energy, and so it doesn't plummet into the nucleus as the Rutherford model predicts. Bohr expected that a similar, if more complicated, scheme would also work for the other elements which have multiple electrons. He saw quantization as the key to the stability of the Rutherford atom, and hence, of all the matter in the universe. Like Planck's work on blackbody radiation and Einstein's explanation of the photoelectric effect, Bohr's ideas were not derived from a general theory of the quantum, but rather were ad hoc concepts concocted to explain only one thing, in this case, the stability of the Rutherford atom. It is a testament to human ingenuity that, despite the absence of any mother theory to birth his model, the Bohr picture, like Planck's and Einstein's, was essentially correct. Bohr would later say that his ruminations on the atom had gelled only after a chance conversation with a friend in February 1913. That friend had reminded him of the laws in a field called spectroscopy, the study of the light given off by an element in gaseous form that has been excited, say by an electric discharge or by intense heat. It had long been known that, for reasons that were not understood, in these situations each gaseous element emits a particular group of electromagnetic waves characterized by a limited set of frequencies. Those frequencies are called spectral lines and form a kind of fingerprint from which elements can be identified. After talking to his friend, Bohr realized that he could employ his model of the atom to predict what the fingerprint of hydrogen ought to look like, thus connecting his theory to the test of experimental data. It is that step, of course, that in science elevates an idea from a promising or beautiful notion to a serious theory. When Bohr finished the math, the results astonished even him. The differences in energy among his allowed orbits reproduced precisely all the frequencies of the many series of spectral lines that had been observed. It is hard to imagine the exhilaration the 27-year-old Bohr must have felt when he realized that, with his simple model, he had reproduced all the spectroscopist's puzzling formulas and explained their origin. Bohr published his masterpiece on the atom in July 1913. He had worked hard for that triumph. From the summer of 1912 to the moment of his inspiration in February 1913, he had wrestled with his ideas day and night, putting in so many hours that even his diligent colleagues were in awe. In fact, they thought he might drop from exhaustion. One incident says it all. He had arranged to be married on August 1, 1912, and he was, but he canceled his honeymoon in scenic Norway and spent the time instead in a hotel room in Cambridge, dictating a paper on his work to his new wife. Bohr's new theory, being such a hodgepodge, was clearly only the beginning. For example, he called the allowed orbits stationary states because the electrons, by not radiating as classical theory required, were behaving as if they did not move. On the other hand, he spoke often of the electrons' state of motion, picturing them circling the nucleus in their allowed orbits until they either jumped to a lower energy orbit or became excited by incoming radiation and jumped to a higher energy state. I mention this because it illustrates the fact that Bohr was employing two contradictory images. This is the approach of many pioneers in theoretical physics. In literature, one is told not to mix metaphors, but in physics, if we know that one metaphor is not totally appropriate, it is common to carefully mix in another. In this case, Bohr was not terribly fond of the classical picture of a solar system atom, but it was his starting point, and to create his new theory, he employed the equations of classical physics that related the radius and energy of the electron orbits, while folding in new quantum ideas like the principle of stationary states, thereby creating a modified picture. The Bohr atom initially met with mixed reactions. At the University of Munich, an influential physicist named Arnold Sommerfeld not only immediately recognized the work as a milestone of science, but began working on the idea himself, in particular exploring its connection with relativity. Meanwhile, Einstein said that Bohr's was one of the greatest discoveries ever. But perhaps most revealing, with regard to just how shocking the Bohr atom appeared to a physicist of his era, was another comment Einstein made. The man who had been brave enough to propose not just the existence of light quanta, but also the idea that space-time and gravity are all intertwined, said of the Bohr atom that he had had similar ideas, but, because of their extreme novelty, had not had the courage to publish them. That publication took courage is reflected by some of the other reactions Bohr received. For example, at the University of Göttingen, a leading German institution, there was, as Bohr later recalled, complete agreement that the whole thing was some awful nonsense bordering on fraud. One Göttingen scientist, an expert in spectroscopy, put the Göttingen attitude in writing. It was regrettable in the highest degree that the literature should be contaminated by such wretched information, betraying so much ignorance. One of the grand old men of British physics, Lord Rayleigh, meanwhile, said he could not bring himself to believe that nature behaved in that way. Yet he added, presciently, that men over 70 should not be hasty in expressing opinions on new theories. Another leading British physicist, Arthur Eddington, was also less than enthusiastic, having already dismissed the quantum ideas of Planck and Einstein as a German invention. Even Rutherford reacted negatively. For one, he had little taste for theoretical physics. But what bothered him about Bohr's work, which was, after all, a revision of his own model of the atom, was that his Danish colleague had provided no mechanism for the electron to carry out those jumps between energy levels that he had postulated. For example, if the electron, in moving to an energy level corresponding to a smaller orbit, is jumping to the new orbit, and not spiraling continuously inward, then just what sort of path does this jump consist of, and what happens to cause it? As it would turn out, Rutherford's objection went precisely to the heart of the matter. Not only would such a mechanism never be found, but when quantum theory matured into a general theory of nature, it would dictate that such questions have no answer, and hence no place in modern science. What eventually convinced the physics world of the correctness of Bohr's ideas, and hence also of Planck's and Einstein's earlier work, came over a 10-year period, from 1913 to 1923. Applying Bohr's theory to atoms of elements that are heavier than hydrogen, Bohr and others realized that by ordering the elements by atomic number rather than by atomic weight, as Mendeleev had done, they could eliminate some errors in Mendeleev's periodic table. The atomic weight is determined by the number of protons and neutrons in the atom's nucleus. The atomic number, by contrast, equals the number of protons, which, since atoms have no overall electric charge, is also the number of electrons that the atom possesses. Atoms with more protons in their nucleus generally have more neutrons as well, but not always, so the two measures can differ in their implications for ordering the elements. Bohr's theory showed that the atomic number is the proper parameter upon which to base the periodic table, because it is the protons and electrons that determine an element's chemical properties, not its neutrons. It had taken more than 50 years, but thanks to Bohr, science could now explain why Mendeleev's mysterious periodic table worked. With the maturation of the quantum ideas into a general structure that would replace Newton's laws, physicists would eventually be able to write down equations from which, in principle, the behavior of all atoms could be derived, though in most cases it would take the technology of supercomputers to derive it. But no one had to wait for supercomputers to test Bohr's ideas regarding the significance of the atomic number. In the Mendeleev tradition, Bohr predicted the properties of a yet undiscovered element. Ironically, one that Mendeleev, having based his system on atomic weight, had gotten wrong. The element was discovered very shortly thereafter, in 1923, and named hafnium, after Hafnia, the Latin name for Bohr's hometown of Copenhagen. With that, no physicist or chemist could ever again doubt the truth of Bohr's theories. Some five decades later, Bohr's name would join Mendeleev's on the periodic table with the naming of element 107, borium, in 1997. That same year, his former mentor and sometime critic was also honored with the naming of element 104, rutherfordium. Chapter 12, The Quantum Revolution. Despite all the brilliant and eager minds now focused on the quantum and the isolated truths they had guessed at or discovered, by the early 1920s, there was still no general theory of the quantum or any hint that such a theory might be possible. Bohr had concocted certain principles that, if true, explained why atoms were stable and accounted for their line spectra. But why were those principles true, and how do you apply them to analyze other systems? No one knew. Many quantum physicists were becoming discouraged. Max Born, a future Nobel Prize winner who would soon introduce the term photon, wrote, "I am thinking hopelessly about quantum theory, trying to find a recipe for calculating helium and other atoms, but I am not succeeding in this. The quanta are really in a hopeless mess." And Wolfgang Pauli, another future Nobel laureate, who would propose and then work out the mathematical theory of the property called spin, put it this way, "Physics is very muddled at the moment. It is much too hard for me anyway, and I wish I were a movie comedian, or something like that, and had never heard anything about physics." Nature offers us puzzles, and it is we who must make sense of them. One thing about physicists is that they invariably have deep faith that those puzzles harbor profound truths. We believe that nature is governed by general rules and is not just a hodgepodge of unrelated phenomena. The early quantum researchers did not know what the general theory of the quantum would be, but they trusted that such a theory would exist. The world they explored was obstinate in its resistance to explanation, but they imagined that it could be made sense of. Their dreams nourished them. They were vulnerable to moments of doubt and desperation, as we all are, yet they marched forward on difficult journeys that consumed years of their lives, motivated by their belief that there would be a reward of truth at the other end. As with any very difficult endeavor, we find that those who succeeded had very strong convictions, because those whose faith was weak dropped out before they could succeed. It is easy to understand the despair of those like Born and Pauli, for not only was quantum theory challenging in and of itself, but it came of age in difficult times. Most of the quantum pioneers worked in Germany, or moved between Germany and the institute that Bohr had raised money to establish in 1921 at the University of Copenhagen. And so, they were fated to conduct their search for a new scientific order at a time when the social and political order around them was dissolving into chaos. In 1922, the German foreign minister was assassinated. In 1923, the value of the German mark sank to a trillionth of its pre-war value, and it took 500 billion of those German dollars just to buy a kilogram of bread. Still, the new quantum physicists sought sustenance in understanding the atom and, more generally, the fundamental laws of nature that apply at that tiny scale. The sustenance finally began to arrive in the middle of that decade. It came in fits and starts, beginning with a paper published in 1925 by a 23-year-old named Werner Heisenberg. Born in Würzburg, Germany, Heisenberg, the son of a classical languages professor, was recognized at an early age as brilliant and competitive. His father encouraged that spirit of competition, and Heisenberg fought frequent battles with his year-older brother. The feud culminated in a bloody fight in which they beat each other with wooden chairs and then called a truce, one that would last mainly because they went their own ways, leaving home and not speaking for the remainder of their lives. In later years, Heisenberg would attack the challenges presented by his work with the same fierceness. Werner would always take competition as a personal challenge. He had no particular talent for skiing, but he trained himself to become an excellent skier. He became a long-distance runner. He took up the cello and the piano. But most important of all, when in grade school, he discovered that he had a talent for arithmetic, it sparked him to take a great interest in mathematics and its applications. In the summer of 1920, Heisenberg decided to pursue a doctorate in math. To be accepted into a program required convincing a faculty member to sponsor you, and through a connection of his father's, Heisenberg managed to obtain an interview with a well-known mathematician named Ferdinand von Lindemann at the University of Munich. As it turned out, it wasn't the good kind of interview you sometimes get through connections, in which Heisenberg might have been offered tea and black forest cake and told that they'd heard amazing stories about his brilliance. Rather, it was the bad kind, in which Lindemann, 2 years from retirement, partially deaf and not very interested in first-year students, kept a poodle on his desk that barked so loudly he could hardly hear Heisenberg. In the end, though, what really seemed to have doomed Heisenberg's chances was that he mentioned having read a book on Einstein's theory of relativity, written by the mathematician Hermann Weyl. Upon learning of the young man's interest in a physics book, Lindemann, a number theorist, abruptly ended the interview, saying, "In that case, you are completely lost to mathematics." With his comment, Lindemann may have meant that showing interest in physics indicates bad taste, though as a physicist, I'd like to think he was really saying that, having been exposed to a far more interesting subject, Heisenberg would never have the patience for mathematics. In any case, Lindemann's arrogance and closed-mindedness changed the course of history, for had he embraced Heisenberg, physics would have lost the man whose ideas would become the heart of quantum theory. Instead, after his rejection by Lindemann, Heisenberg did not see many options and decided to try for the consolation prize of a physics doctorate under Arnold Sommerfeld, who had been a great supporter of the Bohr atom and by then had made his own contributions to the theory. Sommerfeld, a slight, balding man with a large mustache and no poodles, was impressed that young Heisenberg had tackled Weyl's book. Not impressed enough to immediately embrace him, but enough to offer to sponsor him provisionally. "It may be that you know something. It may be that you know nothing," Sommerfeld said. "We shall see." Heisenberg, of course, did know something, enough that he completed his doctorate under Sommerfeld in 1923, and in 1924 received an even more advanced degree called a Habilitation, working under Born in Göttingen. But his path to immortality really started after that, on a visit to Niels Bohr in Copenhagen in the fall of 1924. When Heisenberg arrived, Bohr was leading a misguided effort to amend his model of the atom, and Heisenberg joined it. I say misguided, not just because the effort failed, but because of its aim. Bohr wanted to rid his model of the photon, Einstein's quantum of light. That might sound strange, since it was the idea of light quanta that had first inspired Bohr to think about the notion that an atom might be restricted to having only certain discrete energies. Still, Bohr, like most physicists, was reluctant to accept the reality of the photon, so he asked himself, could one create a variant of the original Bohr atom that didn't incorporate it? Bohr believed he could. We've seen Bohr sweat over ideas and eventually succeed, but this was a case in which he would sweat over an idea and fail. When I was a student, my friends and I idolized a number of physicists. Einstein for his airtight logic and radical ideas. Feynman and British physicist Paul Dirac for inventing seemingly illegal mathematical concepts and applying them to get amazing results. And Bohr for his intuition. We thought of them as heroes, superhuman geniuses whose thinking was always clear and whose ideas were always correct. That's not unusual, I suppose. Artists, entrepreneurs, and sports fans can all name figures they consider larger than life. In my student days, we were told that Bohr's intuition about quantum physics was so impressive that he seemed to have a direct line to God. But while discussions of the early days of quantum theory often tell of Bohr's great insights, they rarely mention his many mistaken ideas. That's natural, because with time, the good ideas survive and the bad ones are forgotten. Unfortunately, that leaves us with the mistaken impression that science is more straightforward and easier, at least for certain geniuses, than it really is. Basketball great Michael Jordan once said, "I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I failed over and over and over again in my life. And that is why I succeed." He said it in a Nike commercial, because to hear that even a legend failed and persisted through his failures is inspirational. But to anyone engaged in the field of discovery or innovation, it is of equal value to hear of Bohr's misguided notions, or Newton's fruitless efforts at alchemy, to recognize that our intellectual idols had wrong ideas and failures as mammoth as the ones we are quite aware of having had ourselves. That Bohr should have considered his own Bohr atom to be too radical an idea is interesting, but not surprising, for science, like society, is built upon certain shared ideas and beliefs, and the Bohr atom did not conform. As a result, pioneers from Galileo and Newton to Bohr and Einstein and beyond had one foot in the past, even as their imaginations helped to create the future. In that, the revolutionaries of science are no different from forward-thinking individuals in other fields. Consider, for example, Abraham Lincoln, champion of freeing the slaves in the American South, who was nevertheless unable to let go of his anachronistic belief that the races will never live together in social and political equality. Lincoln himself realized that one could perceive his stand against slavery to be inconsistent with his tolerance of racial inequality. But he defended his acceptance of the supremacy of Caucasians by saying that whether it accords with justice is not the key issue, because white supremacy is a universal feeling that, whether well or ill-founded, cannot be safely disregarded. To abandon white supremacy, in other words, was too radical a step even for him. If you ask people why they believe this or that, They will not usually be as open or self-aware as Lincoln. Few will say, as he essentially did, that they believe something because everyone else believes it, or because I have always believed it, or because I was indoctrinated to believe it at home and in school. But, as Lincoln remarked, that is often a good part of the reason. In society, shared beliefs create culture and sometimes injustice. In science, art, and other areas where creativity and innovation are important, shared beliefs can create mental barriers to progress. That is why change often comes in fits and starts, and that is why Bohr got bogged down in trying to alter his theory. If Bohr's new theory was doomed, it did have one very fortunate effect. It forced young Heisenberg to think deeply about the implications of Bohr's original theory of the atom. Gradually, Heisenberg's analysis started to move him toward a radical new view of physics, that it might be viable, even desirable, to abandon the idea of a physical picture of the inner workings of the atom, the orbital motion of the electrons, for example, which we imagine in our minds, but in practice cannot observe. Bohr's theory, like the theories of classical physics, rested on mathematical values assigned to features such as the position and orbital velocity of the electron. In the world of objects Newton studied, projectiles, pendulums, planets, position and velocity can be observed and measured. But experimenters in the lab cannot observe whether atomic electrons are here or there, or how fast they are moving, if indeed they are moving at all. If the classical concepts of position, speed, paths, orbits, and trajectories are not observable on the atomic level, Heisenberg reasoned, perhaps one should stop trying to create a science of the atom or other systems that is based on them. Why be wedded to those old ideas? They were mental ballast, Heisenberg decided. So 17th century. Is it possible, Heisenberg asks himself, to develop a theory based only upon atomic data that can be directly measured, such as the frequencies and amplitudes of radiation that atoms emit? Rutherford had objected to the Bohr atom because Bohr gave no mechanism for how the electron jumps among the atom's energy levels. Heisenberg would answer that criticism not by providing that mechanism, but by asserting that there is no mechanism, no path when one speaks of electrons, or at least that the very question is outside the realm of physics, because physicists measure the light absorbed or emitted in such processes, but cannot witness the processes themselves. By the time Heisenberg returned to Göttingen in the spring of 1925 to work as a lecturer in Born's Institute, it had become his dream, his goal, to invent a new approach to physics based purely on measurable data. Creating a radically new science that abandoned Newton's intuitive description of reality and that disavowed concepts such as position and velocity that we can all picture and relate to was an audacious goal for anyone, let alone a 23-year-old like Heisenberg. But like Alexander, who changed the political map of the world at age 22, young Heisenberg would lead a march that reshaped the scientific map of the world. The theory Heisenberg created from his inspiration would replace Newton's laws of motion as our fundamental theory of nature. Max Born would dub it quantum mechanics to distinguish it from Newton's laws, often called Newtonian mechanics or classical mechanics. But the theories of physics are validated by the accuracy of their predictions, not by common agreement or taste. So one might wonder how a theory based on exotic ideas like Heisenberg's could replace a well-established theory like Newton's, which had had so many successes. The answer is that, though the conceptual framework behind quantum mechanics is far different from Newton's, the mathematical predictions of the theories usually differ only for systems on the atomic scale or smaller, where Newton's laws fail. And so, once it became fully developed, quantum mechanics would explain the strange behavior of the atom without contradicting the well-established description of everyday phenomena provided by Newtonian theory. Heisenberg and the others who worked to develop quantum theory knew that this must be the case, and they developed a mathematical expression of the idea that provided useful tests for their evolving theory. Bohr called it the correspondence principle. How did Heisenberg create a concrete theory from what was then little more than a philosophical preference? His challenge was to translate the notion that physics should be based on observables, quantities we measure, into a mathematical framework that, like Newton's, could be used to describe the physical world. The theory he invented would apply to any physical system, but he developed it in the context of the atomic world with the initial aim of explaining, through a general mathematical theory, the reasons for the success of Bohr's ad hoc model of the atom. Heisenberg's first step was to identify the observables that are appropriate for the atom. Since, in the atomic world, what we measure are the frequencies of light that atoms emit and the amplitude or intensity of those spectral lines, it is those properties that he chose. Then, he set out to employ the techniques of traditional mathematical physics to derive the relation between traditional Newtonian observables, such as position and velocity, and that data on spectral lines. His aim was to use that connection to replace each observable in Newtonian physics with a quantum counterpart. That would prove to be a step that required both creativity and courage, because it would demand that Heisenberg turn position and momentum into mathematical entities that looked both new and bizarre. The new type of variable was demanded by the fact that although position, say, is defined by specifying a single point, spectral data requires a different description. Each of the various properties of the light that atoms emit, such as color and intensity, forms not just a single number, but an entire array of numbers. The data form an array because there is a spectral line corresponding to a jump from any initial state of the atom to any final state, producing an entry for every possible pair of Bohr's energy levels. If that sounds complicated, don't worry, it is. In fact, when Heisenberg first came up with the scheme, he himself called it very strange. But the gist of what he did was eliminate from his theory electron orbits one can visualize and replace them with purely mathematical quantities. Those who worked on the theories of the atom before Heisenberg had, like Rutherford, wanted to discover a mechanism behind atomic processes. They had thought of the inaccessible contents of the atom as being real and tried to derive the nature of those observed spectral lines based on guesses about the behavior of what is inside, such as orbiting electrons. Their analysis had always assumed that the components of the atom would have the same basic character as the things we are used to in everyday life. Only Heisenberg thought differently and had the courage to boldly declare that the orbits of the electrons are beyond the scope of observation and hence are not real and have no place in the theory. This would be Heisenberg's approach not just to the atom, but to any physical system. In insisting on such analyses, Heisenberg abandoned the Newtonian picture of the world as an arrangement of material objects that have an individual existence and definite properties such as speed and location. His theory, once perfected, would require us to accept instead a world based on a different conceptual scheme, one in which an object's path and even its past and future are not precisely determined. Given that in today's world, many people have trouble adjusting to new technologies like texting and social media, one can only imagine the mental openness it took to adjust one's thinking to a theory that said that the electrons and nuclei you are made of don't have a concrete existence. But Heisenberg's approach demanded just that. It wasn't just a new kind of physics. It was an entirely new conception of reality. Such issues led Max Born to question the centuries-old split between physics and philosophy. I am now convinced, he wrote, that theoretical physics is actual philosophy. As these ideas began to fall in place for Heisenberg, and his mathematical calculations progressed, he grew increasingly excited. But then he got sick with an attack of hay fever so severe he had to leave Göttingen and retreat to a rocky island in the North Sea on which little or nothing grew. His entire face was apparently horrendously swollen, and yet he kept working day and night and finished the research that would constitute his first paper on the ideas that would turn physics on its head. When he returned home, Heisenberg wrote up his findings and gave one copy to his friend Pauli and another to Born. The paper outlined a methodology and applied it to a couple simple problems, but Heisenberg hadn't been able to apply his ideas to calculate anything of practical interest. His work was very rough, horridly complicated, and extremely mysterious. To Born, confronting it must have been like talking to one of those people you meet at a cocktail party who go on and on but don't make any sense. Most people, faced with reading a paper that difficult, would go at it for a few minutes, then drop it and have a glass of wine. But Born kept at it, and in the end, he was so impressed by Heisenberg's work that he immediately wrote Einstein and told him that the young scientist's ideas were surely correct and profound. Like Bohr and Heisenberg, Born had been inspired by Einstein's relativity and noted that Heisenberg's focus on what can be measured was analogous to Einstein's careful attention in creating relativity to the operational aspects of how time is gauged. Einstein, though, didn't like Heisenberg's theory, and this would be the point in the evolution of quantum theory at which Einstein and the quantum began to part company. Einstein could not bring himself to endorse a theory that gave up on the existence of a well-defined objective reality in which objects have definite properties, like position and velocity. That the properties of an atom might be explainable by a provisional theory that did not reference the atom's orbit, he could stomach. But a fundamental theory proclaiming that such orbits don't exist, this he would not subscribe to. As he would later write, I incline to the belief that physicists will not be permanently satisfied with an indirect description of reality. Heisenberg himself wasn't sure what he had created. He later recounted how giddy he was, working until 3 a.m. one night when he was on the threshold of discovery, and then being so excited by his new findings that he couldn't sleep. Yet while he was working on the manuscript for the first paper setting forth his ideas, he wrote to his father, My own works are at the moment not going especially well. I don't produce very much, and I don't know whether another paper will jump out of this. Born, meanwhile, kept puzzling over Heisenberg's strange mathematics. Then one day, he had an epiphany. He had seen a scheme like Heisenberg's elsewhere. The arrays, he recalled, were like something mathematicians called matrices. Matrix algebra was then an arcane and obscure subject, and Heisenberg had apparently reinvented it. Born asked Pauli to help him translate Heisenberg's paper into the mathematician's matrix language, and to extend that language to allow for the fact that Heisenberg's matrices had an infinite number of rows and columns. The future Nobel laureate Pauli became agitated. He accused Born of trying to ruin his friend's beautiful physical ideas by introducing futile mathematics and tedious and complicated formalism. In reality, the language of matrices would prove a great simplification. Born found himself another matrix algebra helper, his student Pasquale Jordan, and within months, in November 1925, Heisenberg, Born, and Jordan had submitted a paper on Heisenberg's quantum theory that is now a landmark in the history of science. Not long after that, Pauli digested their work and applied the new theory to derive the spectral lines of hydrogen and to show how they are affected by electric and magnetic fields, something that had not previously been possible. It was the first practical application of the nascent theory that would soon unseat Newton's mechanics. More than 2,000 years had passed since the origin of the idea of the atom. More than 200 since Newton invented mathematical mechanics. More than 20 since Planck and Einstein introduced the concept of the quantum. Heisenberg's theory was, in a way, the culmination of all those long threads of scientific thinking. The problem was, once it was fully developed, Heisenberg's theory required 30 pages to explain the atom's energy levels, which Bohr's theory had explained in a few lines. To that, my ever-practical father the tailor would have said, "Oi, for this he's had to study all these years?" And yet Heisenberg's theory was superior, for it produced its result on the basis of deep principles rather than the ad hoc assumptions of Bohr. For that reason, you'd think it would have been instantly embraced. But most physicists were not directly involved in searching for a theory of the quantum, and they seemed to think like my father. To them, requiring 30 pages rather than 3 lines did not seem like a step forward. They, Rutherford conspicuously among them, were unimpressed and uninterested. Viewing Heisenberg the way you'd view an auto mechanic who tells you he could fix your problem with a new thermostat, but it would be better to replace the entire car. The small group of quantum theory cognoscente, however, had a different reaction. Almost without exception, they were floored. For Heisenberg's admittedly complicated theory explained in a profound sense why Bohr's provisional theory of the hydrogen atom had worked, and also provided a complete description of the observed data. For Bohr in particular, this was the culmination of a quest that he had helped to start. He knew his atom was only an ad hoc provisional model, destined to be explained, eventually, by a more general theory, and this, he was convinced, was it. "Due to the last work of Heisenberg," he wrote, "prospects have with a stroke been realized, which have for a long time been the center of our wishes." For a while, physics was in an odd state, like a World Cup stadium in which the winning goal was scored, but only a handful of fans had noticed.